Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. SDPB's A Century of South Dakota State Parks offers a look at the development of the state park system in South Dakota and tells some of the stories behind several of the parks. Photos and historical films reveal the beginnings of traditions that continue today, from feeding the burros on the Custer State Park Wildlife Loop Road to stopping for a photo at the Needle's Eye. SDPB's Brian Gevick joins us for a preview of the new Images of the Past documentary. It airs tonight at 8:30 Central, 7:30 Mountain, on SDPB TV. Brian Gevick, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
You bet. Great to be here.
I'm super looking forward to this one.
Yeah?
I mean, I look forward to all of them.
Yeah.
So I say this every time, but I'm really looking forward to it. I've got my night set aside.
Well, who doesn't love state parks?
Because this is an anniversary. So tell us little bit about, where this idea got started.
Well, South Dakota's very first state park, Custer State Park, opened in 1919, early July of 1919. And State Game Fish and Parks is kind of, commemorating that all year. And they started with the anniversary of the pheasant hunt this past fall. And so, I was made aware of that. And I thought, let's take a look at where the parks have been over the years.
All right. So tell me a little bit about what's featured in the documentary. Where do you want to begin?
Well, let's take the big overview. Okay. There are 13 state parks. Custer State Park in 1919, and the most recently added state park, Good Earth State Park at Blood Run, very close to Sioux Falls, is the most recently added in 2013. There was a proposal to add a state park in Spearfish Canyon. We may get into that later. That proposal is on hold indefinitely.
All right. So let's go back to historically Custer State Park. What went into sort of making that happen in the state?
Peter Norbeck.
Okay.
We've all heard the name. If you're from South Dakota or if you've driven around the hills, you've heard or seen the name Peter Norbeck, and he was a very influential person around the turn of the 20th century. He was elected to the state legislature in 1908. He grew up near Vermilion, but he was working as a well driller in Redfield. Apparently doing okay, because he and some buddies got in their Cadillac and drove from, they drove from Redfield out to the Black Hills, and they just drove around and looked at it. And he, by all accounts, just fell in love with it. And he, was about to be in a position to do something about it. And they had a situation with state lands vis-a-vis federal lands at that time. And so for me, what I was looking at is, how do they actually pull this off? And we have some sound from Lydia Austin, who's the interpretive programs manager for Custer State Park. And I'll set this up by saying, basically, it was all federal land after the federal government essentially took it from the Lakota.
What they did is, instead of having inholdings of state land and federal land, they offered, hey, we will trade this chunk of state land for this chunk of federal land so we can get solid blocks. And both the feds and both the federal system and the state system were in favor of that. By trading school and public lands with federal lands, he got set aside what would become Custer State Park as a game preserve. And this game preserve, they started bringing in animals, buffalo, elk, things like that, to stock it up as a game preserve, bring the wildlife back to the hills, because after the mining, our wildlife numbers had declined. The unique story of Custer State Park is that we had homesteaders and ranchers in the area, and they lived here. This was home. And for a lot of them, they weren't excited about having a state park. This was their home. This was where they hunted. This is where they farmed. And to have the government come in and say, we're going to set up this beautiful state park, you're going to love it, but we're going to buy your lands from you or have you neighbors with it, they weren't too excited, especially when the buffalo and such started coming in. That's competition for their farms and wildlife.
There were dozens of parcels of private land in and around the state game preserve, and some remained in private hands well into the 1930s. But Norbeck wanted the land and spent years acquiring it, one way or another.
Norbeck worked with a lot of the ranchers, descendants of the ranchers, the wives and the children, and bought the lands. And he wheeled and dealed. He knew how to do that.
The state of South Dakota asserted the power of eminent domain in several cases, and eventually the park grew from about 60,000 acres to 72,000 acres at one point. For a time, it was the largest state park in the nation.
So that's a story about process. There's a lot to say about Custer State Park in terms of its history. You can talk about the rocks if you want to.
Right.
and human habitation and so on. But looking at that particular bit of history, I think, should be informative for
right.
folks.
Right, because as we jump ahead to Blood Run and or Good right. Earth and the debate, the political debate over spearfish, these are not easy. It's not just a celebration of look at our beautiful state parks.
Right.
It's complicated.
It is complicated. If you look at Good Earth State Park, it took 30 years to get that park established.
Tell us a little bit about the history of that before we...
Well, I'm going to ask Jim Hanning, the park manager, to talk about that. This was home to native tribes, native peoples, from about 1300 until the early 1700s. Now think about that, 400 years.
Wow.
So here's Jim Hanning.
You know, about 500 years ago, there was a big village in this area or settlement where Native American culture was thriving. And I mean, when I say thriving, it's upwards of maybe 10,000 people living here at one time. And, you know, settlements of that size were a rarity, you know. And so it was an area where different cultures came together. And it was an important place for trade, and multiple tribes would meet here and trade goods and stories and traditions. And, you know, they lived here for a few hundred years. The people that actually lived here were members of the Omaha, Ponca, Iowa, and Odo tribes. And their descendants now live in, you know, Nebraska and Iowa, Oklahoma, Kansas, and you know, they were here until the early 1700s, and for various reasons in the early 1700s they kind of started moving south along the Missouri River.
For folks who have not been to Good Earth, how is that history preserved at the park? Is there interpretation there?
There is, yeah. They have just a beautiful visitor center. They have a reconstructed lodge. You can look at displays about some of the artifacts, look at displays about the people. They have a really nice film that you can sit down and watch, and that explains a lot about it and kind of puts it into proportion in terms of, you know, just think about how many people that was. Now, they were living on both sides of the Sioux River, so you've got half of that village that was in Iowa. Obviously, that's Iowa's park. It's not developed in the same way, but there are plenty of trails where you can walk around at Good Earth and just explore it and kind of, you know, get the feel for that place as it, you know, as it is now.
Right. I was going to say, plus you can take a really nice walk.
Oh, yeah.
Which is what,
absolutely.
I mean, people are doing, running.
And skiing now, this
right.
time of year.
Yeah.
Sure.
What makes a state park a state park? What?
It boils down to history.
Okay.
Each state park, each of the 13 state parks has a really unique history. Something very significant in the state of South Dakota. Now, recreation areas also have their histories. And if you think about, you know, Angostura, if you're down by Hot Springs, or Ormond Dam, north of Belle Fourche, very historic in the way that those dams were constructed and so on. But the state parks are a little bit different in that they go way, way back.
Yeah. All right. So we only have like a minute left.
I know.
And I guess one of the questions people are asking is the conversation about a state park in Spearfish, which was, I mean, residents were turning out in opposition to that
right.
in numbers that were surprising to state government.
Yes.
That conversation isn't over yet, though, but it's sleeping.
It's definitely sleeping. It's not coming back anytime soon. I spoke with Kelly Hepler, who is the Secretary of Game, Fish, and Parks, and he was saying, you know, it's not coming back soon, but that doesn't mean that it's never coming back. And his take on it is that as a department, they have an obligation to look at these ideas and to talk with people, but they're also very interested in the process. I mean, they want to listen to people, and I think the fact that this thing has not moved forward, in my mind at least, indicates that, you know, they are paying attention.
Yeah. And Kristi Noem, when she was in Congress, said had a similar statement. So you would expect that from her as a governor as well, to listen to the people in the region about that park.
Oh. At the same time, it took 30 years. And the thing is, look back at what happened with Custer State Park and Peter Norbeck. And if you want to talk about wacky land swaps and eminent domain and buying property, go have a look.
And this is why Brian Gevick and South Dakota Public Broadcasting do these documentaries. Well, so much to think about. Tune in tonight at 8:30 Central, 7:30 Mountain on SDPB-TV for the new Images of the Past documentary, A Century of South Dakota State Parks.